Three, two, one. All right, gentlemen, we're live. That's my Joe Rogan impersonation.
Is that what he does?
Yeah. And during this time of social isolation, I've dipped into the Joe Rogan YouTube catalog a bit.
So, really? The man who endorsed the man who endorsed Joe Biden.
Right. Exactly. Yes. Well, welcome to Know Your Enemy, listeners. I'm Matt Sittman, one of the podcast co-hosts, and I'm here with my friend Sam Adler Bell.
Hello, Matt. It's me, Sam Adler Bell. So happy to be here with you.
Yes. And by here together, we mean I'm in northern Manhattan, Sam's in Brooklyn, and we're...
Not together.
We're not together. It's really... It does lose something, doesn't it, Sam?
It definitely does. I think the fans and listeners can probably feel it, the distance between us, the longing in our voices.
Yeah, I think so too, to be frank. Now, this is a great episode. We finally had on the show's longtime bete noir, Marshall Steinbaum.
That's right, Marshall, at long last.
Now, Sam, what's Marshall's bio? What do we have to tell listeners about him?
Well, he's an assistant professor of economics at the University of Utah. But if the listeners are familiar with him, they've probably read his work in various outlets. He's a prominent left-wing pundit, a acerbic Twitter personality. You know, he haunts the dreams of neoliberal economists everywhere. And is, as you'll see in the episode, extremely knowledgeable to an almost terrifying and machine-like degree about the history of right-wing economics and sort of the development of the profession over the course of the 20th century.
Yes, and in particular, we talk about the Chicago School. So some of the personalities and figures and ways of thinking associated with the Chicago School, meaning the kind of libertarian elements at the University of Chicago Economics Department, Business School, and Law School.
And it's worth noting that Marshall has some special insight because he himself got his graduate training in economics at the University of Chicago.
Yeah. And Marshall really walks us through in great detail, well, both what happened there, what the ideas that and arguments that they made, and the real consequences it's had in the way almost all of us think about the world.
Exactly.
I mean, that comes through again and again in the conversation, that it might seem like this is an esoteric historical, you know, retrieval by the podcast, being nerds or something, but that really comes through in the podcast, that the kinds of ideas we're talking about here, when someone says, oh, have you ever taken Econ 101? This is what they mean.
That's exactly what they mean, right? It's a classic Know Your Enemy deep dive into a school of thought, a set of figures, and then the tangible impact they had on the development of our politics. So I think people will really enjoy it. And I don't want to give too much away. So do we have any housekeeping, Matt?
Yes. I just think there's a few quick things to note. One of which is the brand new issue of Dissent, their spring issue, now out. Sam and I guest edited it with Lauren Stokes. And we did a webinar, I guess you could call it, just a few days ago. But that issue is now out. I think we're really proud of how it turned out. There's a lot of great stuff in it. And so if you do subscribe to Know Your Enemy on Patreon for the $10 a month mark, you get access, you get a digital subscription to Dissent. So you can read that and you can read everything else from Dissent's history, frankly. So it's a good deal.
It's a great issue. It says Know Your Enemy right on the cover. And we hope you pick it up or read it with your digital subscription. I guess that's a good reminder that folks can get a lot more Know Your Enemy content if they subscribe to our Patreon, which is patreon.com/knowyourenemy, patreon.com/knowyourenemy. And besides that, Matt, should we get to the interview?
Yeah, I think so. Well, here's Marshall Steinbaum.
Enjoy.
Well, Know Your Enemy listeners, the time has finally arrived. against my protest, Sam forced this upon me, but at long last, we're welcoming Marshall Steinbaum to Know Your Enemy. Welcome, Marshall.
Thank you. It's great to finally be here.
I couldn't delay it any longer.
We kind of like Jewish mafia'd Sittman.
Yeah, I was going to say, it was an international Jewish cabal forcing this on innocent Christians, as we do control the media.
Matt woke up in his bed and there was a bunch of like pickled herring in his sheets. He knew we were coming for him.
That's right. That's right. But I'm glad we finally are able to have this conversation. It's been a long time coming.
You have been correct, Marshall, that it's absurd that we haven't had you on yet.
Thank you. Thank you.
It's because this is such an important topic that you're very knowledgeable about and that our listeners have actually kind of been clamoring for, which is that we are going to talk about libertarianism, the Chicago School, and some of the key figures that make up that constellation of conservative economic thinking.
Well, if I can break in, I would say if our listeners are aware of, you know, some of the distinctions among libertarian schools of thought or something close to libertarian schools of thought, they would know that maybe the Austrian school exists. And, you know, they might know of Ron Paul and Rand Paul, and they might know something about George Mason, and they might know something about the University of Chicago. So maybe, too, you could trace out some of the history because... and I'm thinking especially of the Mont Pelerin Society, because someone like Friedrich Hayek, you know, is considered an Austrian and associated with the Mont Pelerin Society, but also associated with the University of Chicago and the economic thinking that that school produced. And so, you know, hit some of those notes as you go along and tell our listeners about some of the finer distinctions here.
Sure. Happy to do that. So the University of Chicago, and particularly its economics department, had been conservative within the overall firmament of United States mainstream economics departments from its founding, I think it's fair to say. So the University of Chicago dates to the early 1890s. There was a whole controversy surrounding the establishment of its economics department right off the bat. They considered hiring as its first chairman the man who was then essentially the leading, probably progressive economist in the United States, Richard Ely, but ultimately didn't, and hired a guy named Lawrence Laughlin, who was a professor at Harvard and a known kind of conservative within the constellation of U.S. Economics departments. And from that time on, I think it's fair to say that, as I said, the University of Chicago Economics Department was conservative. In particular, in the 1930s, when the New Deal, well, the Roosevelt administration was elected and the New Deal started to be put in place, the leading figures of that department in those days were the economics profession's leading critics of the Roosevelt administration and the New Deal. So the New Deal at the time reflected a great deal of scholarship and input and was quite consonant with the academic tenor of most of economics as it was then practiced, but not so the University of Chicago. The University of Chicago econ department had its leading critics within the profession within it. And it is from that soil that the post-war Chicago school grew out of. So Milton Friedman, Aaron Director, George Stigler, those figures that became the leaders of the post-war Chicago school were involved in doctoral training at the University of Chicago in the 30s under that older generation of conservative economists, Frank Knight and Jacob Viner, for example. So effectively, the major background for the Chicago school is what to do about the crisis of 19th century liberalism in the Great Depression and in response to the New Deal. And this is where the Mont Pelerin Society came out of. The way to interpret that group is as a international body of scholars and kind of, I don't want to, pseudo-scholar sounds dismissive, although I would be in some cases, you know, kind of intellectual adjacent figures who wanted to, as I would say, preserve some vestiges of 19th century liberal ideology, the free market, what's now called, I guess, classical liberalism, in an era where basically that ideology had come to be discredited, and we were living in a much more state-driven economic policy landscape. So Hayek, as you mentioned, was a leading figure in the Mont Pelerin Society. He also toured the United States, I think, either like right at the end of or just after the end of World War II, and in that at that point came in contact with some anti-New Deal businessmen in the U.S. who were interested effectively in funding a kind of anti-Rooseveltian intellectual movement. I mean, I don't know if they would have gone so far as to say it, but they saw a kind of intellectual crisis where they couldn't rely on their old friends in the academy anymore because that was unfriendly territory. And so they were kind of driven back on their heels and needed to regroup and start something to say. I mean, as they viewed it, you know, capitalism as a whole was on its last legs. I mean, of course, I think more recent interpretations of the New Deal would be that it's what saved capitalism. It was, in fact, a compromise with capitalism. That isn't how they saw it. They saw it as, you know, the imminent destruction of the free market system.
I was going to say, I think Hayek was in the U.S. touring on behalf of The Road to Serfdom.
Yes, that's right.
Kind of a book tour, and which was a huge like bestseller. And even it was, I think, kind of published in, you might say, condensed and almost comic book form in Reader's Digest.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
So like millions and millions of Americans had encountered Hayek and his thinking. So when he toured the U.S., there's a reason like people were looking to him and maybe seeking to make these connections, because he was like really carrying this flag at that time.
Right. I think that's an important point to draw out, because, you know, as I said, these people viewed themselves as being under grave threat. Roosevelt had just been elected four times. And then this guy publishes what is obviously a kind of anti-New Deal type pamphlet, which is saying, you know, the policies that have just been enacted are the first step down a road to totalitarianism. And it looks like it has millions of supporters and is able to reach a wide audience. So to an elite kind of anti-New Deal businessman type set, that's like, oh, this is exactly what we're looking for, a way to build a counter insurgency among that has some sort of popular support, because that's exactly what we lost in the 1930s. So when Hayek was doing this book tour and the book was doing so well, particular anti-New Deal individuals kind of latched onto that and were like, oh, you know, we need to keep this going. We need to water this plant and have it grow in the United States. There was a guy named Herbert Lunau is who I'm referring to. He was an official of a furniture company based in Kansas City and had inherited his uncle's like local foundation that he then repurposed to be the kind of prototype of these right-wing donor influence organizations. He got Hayek to agree to publish, like, I think it was supposed to be a sort of more simplified version of The Road to Serfdom. I'm forgetting exactly the details. That is actually the book that ended up being Milton Friedman's Capitalism and Freedom, I think, because Hayek never did the exact project that he had been funded to do by the Volcker Fund through Lunau. But basically, the origin of the Chicago School, to bring it to the University of Chicago, is that Lunau kind of nabbed Hayek and then went to Henry Simons, who was one of the people involved in the 1930s University of Chicago-oriented opposition to the New Deal, and said, like, yeah, I want you to put Hayek at the University of Chicago permanently in an academic position to be our guy. And I'm talking here about 1946 or so. So that was how the money came into the University of Chicago. It, as it happens, basically the university rejected it, at least at first. That caused Henry Simons to commit suicide, in fact. And the reason why they rejected it, but ultimately placed it at the law school, was internecine academic conflict between the economics department and pretty much every department at the university and the guy who was then the president. And so what that meant was that the economics department rejected the money because this was viewed as being a sort of administration project to place Hayek at the University of Chicago. And so that ultimately deflected the funding to the law school. So that's where the, quote, free market study ended up, even though that was kind of oriented towards free market economics. That's what planted the seed of free market economics at the University of Chicago Law School, because there the president of the university exercised more direct influence because he had been the dean, basically.
Yeah. Now, Marshall, there's two points I want to make here. One is, just for our listeners, the Volcker Fund that you mentioned, that is hugely important in the history of the American right, or the post-war American right, because you, in the early days of the conservative movement, the Volcker Fund was seeding money everywhere. And it's very hard to read histories of some of these figures on the right, some of the institutions on the right, without coming across the Volcker Fund. And as you mentioned, it sort of served as a model for the kinds of foundations we discussed in our episode on the Koch brothers. The Volcker Fund really was important. So I just wanted to underscore that. But maybe you could talk too about the kind of substantive distinctions we see in the Chicago School. Kind of once the money's planted at the University of Chicago and the kind of Chicago school develops. What's distinctive about it as a kind of school of thought?
Yeah, so I think this is actually really a crucial point because it has not been really fully crystallized either by intellectual historical scholarship that is, you know, friendly and kind of could be seen as a boostering of the Chicago school, or as the more critical scholarship that I'm pretty much drawing on in what I'm saying here. You know, if I had to give references here, it would be the work of Phil Murawski and his students and collaborators, characterizing what he calls the neoliberal thought collective. So speaking of the kind of formal economic background to it, it is the idea that you can make statements about how the economy works that derive from the individual optimizations that are undertaken by economic agents, and then group all of those optimizations together to create a picture of some sort of economic outcome or economic situation that you can then characterize and perform counterfactuals on. So, for example, like what would happen if we raise the minimum wage? Oh, that would cause people to lose their job.
Yeah. To take a random example.
No. I mean, that's obviously a famous one. I don't mean to be facetious in that. In characterizing this, it's important to understand what they came after and what they displaced, because they were so successful intellectually that there's almost no institutional memory of economics as it was practiced at the time that they were, at the time, basically very minoritarian critics or outsiders against. So the interwar U.S. institutional school of economics is essentially what we would maybe call economic history now, that is to say practiced by historians. So it's a very quantitative, very statistical, but not very based on the theory of individual optimizing behavior, whatever, however, that, so there are many ways that that's construed in the way that modern economic theory works, but it's more descriptive, much more empirical, and basically, in the view of the Chicago scholars, not robust, because it couldn't be used, I would say weaponized, in order to make the kinds of statements that they wanted to make. So Milton Friedman has a famous essay called The Methodology of Positive Economics. I think it was published in 1951. Economics is notoriously a deficient subject when it comes to teaching its own practitioners about its own methodology. It's the kind of thing you pick up on the job and you do whatever your advisor did. And so that can create lots of pathologies. If a modern contemporary economist has read any work of methodology, it is probably that essay. But they have read that essay without knowledge of its real significance or its motivation in writing it, which was an attack on the institutionalist school of economics. So it's basically the claim that we're not trying to describe reality. That's what the institutionalists did. We're trying to predict reality, and you can't judge our success or failure at the effort that we're engaged in by judging the veracity or non-veracity of the modeling assumptions that we make in order to get to our predictive conclusions. And so it's basically a wholesale rejection of institutionalist economics, not on the grounds that this has failed as a empirical social science, as a positive social science, but rather that it doesn't let us do the intellectual performance that we would like to perform.
It's worth highlighting for the listeners like how significant that is, because when every time you have like a conversation about the minimum wage or about labor unions or about what like the government can do, what progressive policy can do, and some random asshole says, "You obviously don't understand the basics of economics." Like, that person is using the language and the sort of like ideological foundations of this school, which was a initially marginal set of assumptions about like economic reality, which have become so normalized in our academic institutions and our public life and our policy thinking that like every motherfucker who's ever like taken an economics course in high school or college is spewing those exact set of assumptions with no sense of the fact that it actually like is a historical phenomenon that intervened and fundamentally changed the discipline at a particular moment in time.
Yeah, I mean, the essay I referred to, The Methodology of Positive Economics, you know, intellectual history has shown, I mean, I guess kind of recovered the fact that that essay was actually written directly in response to a publication by an institutionalist economist that said, oh, look, I investigated whether increasing the minimum wage killed jobs, and I found out that it didn't. And Friedman's response to that was, no, let's step back, stroke our chins a little bit. doesn't matter what you actually found the effect of the minimum wage might be. That's not how we do economics. The way that we do economics, and here he's obviously lifting a gigantic epistemological load because this guy had just was an economist doing economics. The way we do economics is by ignoring reality and instead reasoning from a priori assumptions about individual behavior and the conditions under which it's performed and how it's aggregated.
Just to maybe lay out on the table now, listeners might be thinking, oh, well, everything they've described so far, Marshall, you used the term how these models can be weaponized or how these assumptions can be weaponized, and that the Chicago School sought to make interventions in policy. And one thing I think it's worth emphasizing is that, you know, you hear the term libertarian, you might think this meant simply rolling back regulations, that it was like anti-statist. But in a way, what's interesting about this kind of iteration of, well, it's really an iteration of neoliberalism, is that it was not so much against the state as that it wanted to capture and control it.
I mean, I couldn't agree with that more.
It's not just like the absence of regulations, the absence of government meddling. It's that there was something more constructive and positive. It wasn't just striking down this or that law or regulation, but there was something. It was kind of using the state to shield markets from democracy.
Yeah.
I just think when you hear the term libertarian, you think of, again, rolling back regulations, not kind of like capturing the regulatory apparatus to be used for certain ends.
Right. And when you do start listening to and reading what these people actually said about what their intentions were, especially those of them whose work was more directed towards other people in the profession, towards regulators, towards people in government, you see that like there's no like democratic impulse here. Quite the opposite.
Yeah.
I would say that they've been masterful at both executing and instantiating exactly the set of priorities you just outlined, which is we need the government and the exercise of power to suppress bottom-up social movements, to tamp down on popular sentiment affecting the policies of government, and also affecting a kind of populistic anti-establishment pose in the way that they presented those ideas. I mean, I'm thinking here especially of Milton Friedman, who was very good at saying, you know, I agree with your overall priority of, say, reducing inequality or helping the poor. It's just that the ways you want to go about it won't work, like raising the minimum wage because of economics. Instead, we have to eliminate regulations, reduce taxes. That's actually the egalitarian, populistic policy agenda. It so happens to be the exact things I'm being paid to advocate for by large corporate interests. But leave that aside, he was very good at presenting that in a sort of populistic garb. Okay, so libertarianism as an idea brings up small state, rollback regulations, everyone should be autonomous in their own sphere, laissez-faire in social and economic affairs. Whether or not that is a good summary of libertarianism, it is definitely not a good shorthand for what the Chicago School is all about. As you alluded to, you know, these were people who had a very defined policy agenda. And I think certainly more so than small government, it would be accurate to characterize it as anti-New Deal. And the one illustrative data point in that happens to be the subject of all of their scholarship that I have studied the most or nearly the most, which is antitrust. So in the 1930s, when the Roosevelt administration's policy was the National Industrial Recovery Act that involved cartelization of most industries, the publication of set prices agreed to by industry and labor and government representatives, and basically the planning of the economy at the federal level, the view of the Chicago people was antitrust is great. We should not be having all these businesses get together to control the economy. Instead, we should have lawsuits brought to break them up and prevent their cartels. That's actually how you preserve the free market as Adam Smith intended it. That was not the view that they expressed about antitrust policy when it was actually part of federal policy in the progressive era. In the early 1930s, when they were saying, oh, antitrust is great, at that point, antitrust was like totally off the table. Basically, the Sherman Act was a dead letter. It was like that was a forgotten relic of the, you know, that we tried 20 years ago to tame corporate power and it failed. Then the Roosevelt administration kind of out of nowhere adopted a very robust antitrust policy in the late 1930s. I could give you a whole podcast episode about that. In fact, I did on Max Alvarez's podcast. And basically, that became a much more prominent aspect of federal economic policy starting in the late 30s and through the late 40s with a bunch of crucial Supreme Court decisions and some more legislation. The Chicago School totally did a 180 when the Roosevelt administration did a 180 on antitrust. Then antitrust, this thing that they had been saying was small government and preserving the free market, became the heavy hand of the state that was actually crushing competition in the exercise of the policy. So it's not so much a principled adherence to free market, but rather opposition to any effective policy apparatus in the hands of egalitarian political and economic movement and a state that is answerable to that movement. All right. So finally, to get to this question of delineations within the Chicago School. So as we've been saying, there's the kind of the economics department. That is where Knight and Viner were active in the 30s. That is where Friedman and Stigler trained or were partly trained in the 30s under their direction. As I said, in the 40s, the department rejected the Volcker Fund's funding, and that ended up placing the free market study, as it was called, the thing that the Volcker Fund funded, at the law school. So that was ultimately under the supervision and direction of this guy, Aaron Director, who was Milton Friedman's brother-in-law, and hadn't been his colleague. I mean, I guess they were the fact that they were brother-in-laws was posterior to them being colleagues, because they had been colleagues in the PhD program along with Director's sister, who became Friedman's wife in the 30s. And, you know, ultimately that's, you know, Friedman, as happens in graduate school, it's been heard tell that people end up getting together as questionable as that may be, a lifetime judgment matter.
Well, Friedman and his wife later, like, wrote books together and stuff, right?
Yeah, she was important. Rose Friedman.
Yes, that would be an example of a successful, I guess, from a romantic and professional perspective.
It seems like a happier marriage than another great University of Chicago romance from that period, which was Philip Reeve, who's one of the favorites of, like, Rod Dreher and a lot of conservatives, to Susan Sontag. But this is a not atypical story in that in the new biography of Sontag, Benjamin Moser basically says that she wrote Reeve's book on Freud, The Mind and the Moralist.
Of course she did.
And then of course they,
and then he took credit.
yeah, took credit. It was his name on the cover, and they eventually split up. But that was who Sontag had David Reeve with, the journalist who's still probably a lot of us have read.
Yes. So retrograde gender politics, including within marriages and households, unfortunately, is not confined yes. to only the right wing of the economics yeah. profession. Let's say that.
All right.
So Director was at the law school overseeing this free market study that became the antitrust project. It was specifically converted to that as a result of those Supreme Court cases I mentioned earlier, where the government basically won a lot of cases that they would have lost. They did lose in the late 19-teens, which is to say very ambitious by modern standards, monopolization claims against powerful corporations. You know, those corporations then trotted over to Director at the University of Chicago Law School and said, you know, we need to formulate a counterattack. Here's decades worth of funding, basically, to make that happen. Obviously, my narrative is a bit reductive, but that is the origins of the Chicago School of Economics as practice at the law school. And then the other kind of prong of this is the business school that didn't exactly get off the ground until a bit later. But the University of Chicago had a business school, I think, from much earlier. I think the actual formation of it was in the teens, but it wasn't inflected with this kind of economistic thinking until the post-war era, and in some ways spilling over from the economics department. The major figures associated with making the University of Chicago Business School into what it became are Alan Wallace, who was the dean and then subsequently became the president of the University of Rochester, and then George Stigler, whom he hired. And the hiring, so Stigler had been a PhD student at Chicago in the 30s, had done various other things. I think he was at the University of Minnesota, if I recall correctly, when he was hired to Chicago in the 50s. the hiring of Stigler to the business school was a crucial moment in the history of the Chicago School because it was done with an endowment that had been given to the university as part of the denouement of a academic controversy that took place in the 30s. So basically, this businessman, Charles Walgreen, the founder, I think, and namesake of the drugstore, I think that's right, had kind of criticized the university because his niece went there. So one thing that's actually true about the University of Chicago is it was gender egalitarian at the undergraduate level much earlier than the Ivies were. And that is part of the legacy of John D. Rockefeller, actually, I believe. Anyway, so his niece was a student there in the 30s. He kind of said in the press or said in some sort of controversial setting, she's being indoctrinated with communism. What are those professors getting up to at this university? You know, they make this pretense to elite status, but they're just a bunch of, left-wing, subversive agents. So that kind of academic politics was going on long before William F. Buckley really perfected it. Anyway, that was very controversial. He was criticized in the press, and as part of the sort of settlement of that controversy, he gave an endowment to the University of Chicago in the 30s that the University of Chicago did nothing with until they hired Stigler. So the problem was, it seems like that the endowment had a tacit requirement that Walgreen or one of his associates be consulted as to which professor would be appointed with its funds. And Walgreen kept rejecting people. Essentially, we don't know this for certain, but most likely because he viewed them as exactly exacerbating the thing he was criticizing in the first place, namely being too left-wing. And that endowment was housed in the political science department. When Stigler was eventually hired, it was because that endowment was transferred to Wallace at the business school, or he made a pitch to the president that said, let me handle this. And part of the handling of it was basically taking recommendations and putting and going to a right-wing donor network and think tank world, a proto-think tank world, and saying, you know, who do you want? Because that's definitely going to be who Walgreen wants. And the person he specifically consulted was Leonard Reed, the head of the FE, which is the Foundation for Economic Education, I think it stands for. So this is a notorious early kind of right-wing organization that's founded, probably funded originally by the Volcker Fund as well. I don't know that for certain, but I would guess that's the case. So Leonard Reed was, the equivalent of, I don't know, some like the Arthur Brooks, the head of the American Economics Enterprise, the American Enterprise Institute, kind of right wing factotum who has the ear of the right wing donor class. And he said, Stigler is our guy. I will convince Walgreen to accede to Stigler because he's right wing. And in particular, Stigler and Friedman had written a pamphlet on like how rent control is bad for fee in the 40s. So it's like, I cultivated this guy and I will get him a professorship, a fancy professorship at this business school. Sorry, I know this is going on a long time. I just want to conclude with one statement about this, which is the business school aspect of the Chicago School is, I think, the one that's most closely attuned to what you referred to as being anti-regulatory and particularly oriented towards not just policy, because that's true of all of them, but the functioning of the federal regulatory bureaucracy. So things like the Federal Communications Commission. I think we'll talk about pharmaceuticals in a moment. But that kind of place where the government places a lot of, even before the Chicago School got involved, places a lot of discretion in kind of expert policymaking bodies. It is that aspect of the of the Chicago School that is the one operating through the business school that was most influential at turning such high level kind of elite policy making apparatus in a direction that was much friendlier to corporate interests, definitely contrary to what Roosevelt thought he was doing when he was giving a role to elite academics in the formulation of federal policy.
There's an interesting way in which Stigler and Friedman are interesting foils and parallels. In one sense, because Friedman is more of a macroeconomist and Stigler is more of a microeconomist, but also in the sense that the focus of his work was, like you're saying, directed at these figures within government who have this discretionary power. And it is explicitly not the sort of popularizing project that Friedman was engaged in. Like Friedman was, you know, I was watching, you know, a bunch of YouTube videos of Friedman, like on television. You know, he was constantly kind of the public face of libertarian economics and libertarian political philosophy in American public life, and was sort of popularizing these ideas according to the sort of like gimmicky propaganda techniques that you were describing earlier, that he's like saying, oh, we all share the same goals, but you know, you're wrong about how it will actually play out, in the sort of, you know, early listeners to the podcast will remember the perversity thesis. You know, you think you're going to do this, but actually it's going to turn out the opposite of what you expect. That was sort of Friedman move all the time. And he's on Phil Donahue, like making that argument. At the same time, you know, Stigler is sort of making this case for a, like a priesthood, right? Like that, that economic affairs have to be administered by a small group of people who are insulated from democratic impulses and democratic instincts, the democratic instincts and preferences of the public, because if we allow the democratic impulse of the public to, you know, orient economic policy, it will be, you know, a totalitarian disaster or just a economic disaster for the country. And there was a quote that was in one of those essays that Marshall, you sent along from Edward Nicott. This was a Stigler quote where he says, affairs of science and intellectual life generally are not to be conducted on democratic procedures. One cannot establish a mathematical theorem by a vote, even a vote of mathematicians. Therefore, an elite must emerge and instill higher standards than the public or the profession instinctively desire. The best economics in the U.S. is not the one the public would elect. A science must impose the standards of an elite upon a profession. I think that is like a really great synthesis of the thing that Matt was alluding to earlier and that you described, Marshall, which is this sort of anti-democratic impulse. The point is to speak to the small group of enlightened economists who share a set of presuppositions, a priori assumptions, who will, you know, direct the economy according to those priorities, which is shields a massive normative agenda behind the idea of sort of like iron laws of economics, but which in order to be successful specifically has to be a conversation amongst people, amongst the priesthood and insulated from the impulses of the masses.
Yeah, I mean, I think that puts it exactly right. I think the great success that these people all had actually wasn't so much about formulating their own small body of scholars that all agreed about how the economy works and how a method, how an economist goes about doing economics. It was kind of about convincing a much broader set of elite policymakers and stakeholders of their correct way of thinking than it was about formulating it amongst themselves. So as you were just describing, mindset that they would have about, you know, overcoming, you know, that, that a small elite of technocrats needs to be able to formulate policy without democratic input. And, you know, there's no way we can get things right if it's put up for a majority vote. You know, that is strongly redolent of a lot of things that go on in the government that aren't done exactly by these people, but are carried out by essentially the people who are supposed to be their ideological opponents. So I'm thinking here of, you know, for example, the Higher Education Act of 1972 that replaced basically funding of institutions at the federal level with the student debt loan system. I mean, that's what it became. It wasn't obvious that's what was going to happen in 1972. You know, that was basically heavily influenced by the scholarship of, you know, among other people, James Buchanan, who I think we'll get to, who basically said, you know, in a world where university is free, you have students who don't take their work seriously and just screw around and go to protests. If we impose student debt on them, on the other hand, that will discipline them, make them attend to their studies because they know they're going to have to pay those loans back and then, you know, go out into the workforce and get jobs like they're supposed to and, you know, get a haircut, basically. And, you know, that policy was carried out by Democratic administrations. It was espoused at the federal level by officials who are career Democrats in terms of how they got their career, how they navigated their careers in Washington. And they were basically carrying out the policies under the policies of the Chicago School under the same ideological kind of assumptions about the dangers of democracy and mass movements and bottom-up demands. that the Chicago School operated under.
Well, I did want to make one quick point in terms of conservative lore for our listeners, which is that the Walgreen money that you're referencing, Marshall, also financed a lecture series called the Walgreen Lectures. And that was kind of important to the history of conservatism, in particular for two books that came out of lectures, which was Leo Strauss's Natural Right and History and Eric Voegelin's The New Science of Politics, which is where the phrase Bill Buckley popularized, the immanentizing the eschaton, comes from that book. But we don't need to be detained by such matters. But I did think this discussion lent itself well to, Marshall, an article you sent to Sam and I as maybe some background reading, and it's called Neoliberal Pharmaceutical Science in the Chicago School of Economics. It's in an academic journal called Social Studies of Science and was published in 2014. And it's by a figure we've mentioned a couple times in this conversation, Edward Nikah, who teaches at Roanoke College in Virginia. And it's really one reason we wanted to discuss it is because it's such a great concrete example of many of the ideas and themes we've discussed so far. It's kind of like the Chicago School in practice. Now, I had not read anything about this before, and it kind of picks up on the idea of medical neoliberalism, kind of this emerging body of work, but it really traces, in particular, some of the debates around the regulation of the pharmaceutical industry to interventions by the Chicago School. And the background to this is basically that in 1962, Congress passed regulation that, well, regulated the pharmaceutical industry, especially with kind of how drugs were tested, what claims could be made about them, kind of the flow of information to doctors and the public about the uses of various pharmaceuticals. It was called the Kefauver-Harris Amendments to the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act in 1962. And basically, this caused both the pharmaceutical industry and various economists affiliated with the Chicago School to become quite worried. And it's kind of the story told in this article is of how they fought back.
Well, I mean, I think what the article recounts is that basically they saw so these scholars, I think specifically Stigler, sought funding from pharmaceutical companies that were obviously directly affected by the act, and the funding that they provided to his center basically supported scholarship that was designed to show that actually the regulation of the pharmaceutical industry reduces innovation. This is kind of so one of the kind of sets of bodies of scholarship that arises or that's associated with the Chicago School is this idea that basically patents are good. It's contained within the patent powers of the Constitution, but the idea is, more protections for intellectual property cause more innovation because they allow inventors to reap higher returns, and so that's going to, put people to work. So if it's kind of in some ways the opposite of the usual free market economics. We want the economy to be as competitive as possible because that reduces distortions and rent seeking and makes everything super efficient. When it comes to intellectual property, the Chicago School line is we want it to be as onerous as possible because that's going to cause innovation and it's actually dynamically efficient because that will increase economic growth in the long run. So it is basically from that the crucial thing that Nikash shows there is, it took this massive funding from the pharmaceutical industry to shift the line, so to speak, on pharmaceuticals on intellectual property more generally from, this is a distortion to the free market. Why would we create a monopoly? Why would we want the government to create a monopoly? I mean, in other contexts, Stigler was scathing and attacked directly the idea that regulation reduces competition because it means that only the best, only the most politically connected firms are allowed to retain. In the context of intellectual property, it was, no, we want maximum regulation, maximum monopoly power on the part of companies with intellectual property, because that's actually good for the rest of us, because even if we're paying high prices for drugs, that there's going to be more drugs and better drugs developed in the long run. That is basically the argument. And you hear that argument all the time in the current context. You hear it outside pharmaceuticals, since we're now in the middle of a global pandemic. The libertarians are all about saying, like, no, why would we price control pharmaceuticals? Then we'll be sick forever. The great minds need to emerge from their cave and hand down a coronavirus vaccine so that we can all survive. And of course, if they do that, then they should be rich by right. And you had this kind of thing. I had a little back and forth with the prominent libertarian Will Wilkinson, because he had a thing in the New York Times a year or so ago that was like, billionaires are good. Stop attacking billionaires. They're good because, you know, look at this guy who invented some treatment that caused him to be a billionaire. And it's like, okay, yeah, but also the Sackler family. Specifically the Chicago School line on intellectual property and drug development arises from this very direct funding of the opposition, the intellectual opposition and academic opposition that came to reinterpret federal pharmaceutical policy in a way that was much more, much friendlier to incumbent firms with valuable intellectual property, or intellectual property that became much more valuable as a result of this higher protection.
Right. So that's a great example of earlier when I said that this school of thought and kind of an emerging understanding of neoliberalism more broadly, when we say it didn't want to simply deregulate, but kind of capture and control regulation, the intellectual property of pharmaceuticals is a great example of that. They weren't about kind of ruling back those protections, but it's worth emphasizing how they did it. Because as I mentioned, this legislation is passed in 1962. And one of the things that spurred it was that there was a congressional investigation into, in the late 50s, about like wonder drugs and claims made behalf on drugs and how drugs were marketed and our off-label use of drugs and that kind of thing. And one of the drugs they investigated was one called thalidomide, and it was found to have caused thousands of birth defects. It was like a sedative that was commonly used. So what happened was the legislation is passed in 1962, like resistance to it builds. And by 1972, you have a big conference at the University of Chicago called the Conference on the Regulation of the Introduction of New Pharmaceuticals. But it was all bankrolled by the pharmaceutical industry, Pfizer, Smith, Merck, et cetera. And of course, a number of prominent figures associated with the University of Chicago were there, like Friedman, like Stigler. And out of this conference comes a book that kind of collected the essays, and it really received like a sort of thrashing in among reviewers because of some of the views it held. But it really was an important kind of gathering of these forces. One of the things I wanted to ask you about, Marshall, that really comes through in this article is the capture and deployment of regulatory capacities that we just mentioned is one of them. But another one was a kind of the way they talk about the knowledge the market contains that kind of no human mind could comprehend. And so one of the arguments,
very Hayekian.
Yes,
knowledge.
Yes, thing. And so one of the things that comes out of, and this might get to the more populist elements. One of the things that comes out of this is the idea that patients should be able to decide what medicine they take. Doctors and patients should be able to make those decisions, and like to have a single kind of government agency do elaborate trials on which drugs are safe or not. You know, that's just one expert opinion. And there might be countervailing opinions from different doctors or patients who want to take a certain risk because they think the rewards outweigh it. Or, you know, so you get the capture of regulations that are friendly to certain businesses. But then when it comes to, using drugs in different ways, how drugs are deemed safe or not, and kind of those sorts of regulations, there's this populist appeal to kind of the common sense of ordinary people.
It's also, I think, a product of this kind of slippage that happens when it comes to like ideology and like pecuniary profit seeking or self-interest, where like in one instance, when members of this school or economists conducting these studies are participating in these plenary discussions about intellectual property and the pharmaceutical industry and whatever, like in one instance, their financial interests are being served by coming to particular conclusions. In another instance, they might think, well, I'm just applying, you know, this like high-minded concept of Hayekian knowledge, this sort of idea of like, the market is not just a goods distribution mechanism, it's an epistemological, you know, technology that it's of great use because no other sort of human invention has ever been as effective at like, you know, coming to good, accurate conclusions about the efficacy of one thing or another, which is just to say that like we're never going to be able to completely distinguish between sort of the philosophical draw of a set of like intellectual ideas that someone has embraced and the like financial benefit they might that might accrue to them by coming to particular conclusions. These things are co-constitutive in every moment. Like that's a sort of first premise of intellectual, you know, history for me.
Yeah. And Marshall, I want to pose this as a kind of question to you, a kind of statement that turns into a question, which is that another strain that comes out of this conference on the pharmaceuticals and the kind of the essays that came out of it and that were put together in this book. One of the people involved in that was a guy named Sam Peltzman. And he did this interview. And I thought this was such a telling statement. He did an interview. And again, this goes back to the drug thalidomide, the one that caused the birth defects, where what he says is that, sure, like maybe you can regulate, maybe certain regulations would have prevented that drug from causing birth defects. But what about all the other great drugs we're missing out on by having these too rigid, too onerous regulations? And this is what he said. He said, it turns out that the cost of the 1962 amendment is far in excess of the cost of having thalidomide tragedy. Again, a tragedy involving those drugs. And then he says, I will have to say, however very shocking it might seem, that we don't have enough thalidomide tragedies in the United States today. And that's like a shocking thing to say. He's saying we don't have enough kind of horrific examples of birth defects from drugs that aren't carefully tested and regulated enough. But he said that's he was willing to bear those costs if it meant a kind of explosion of various drugs and research and pharmaceuticals being tried. That the regulations outweighed, that the cost of the regulations were too high, and they, in fact, he's willing to bear those risks if it meant a less regulated drug industry. Marshall, maybe you could tell us like what people like that mean by cost and just what trade-offs they're willing to make. I mean, this guy said, I'm willing to risk thousands of birth defects if it means we have a kind of more creative or more loosely regulated pharmaceutical industry.
True story, I actually know Sam Peltzman. He and I were co-congregants of a synagogue in Hyde Park when I lived in Chicago. What you recount is actually not what he's best known for, although it is illustrative of what he's best known for. If you ask an economist what the Peltzman effect is, they'll refer to another statement he made about misguided regulation, which was that the auto safety standards that were adopted in response to Ralph Nader's unsafe at any speed in the early 1970s, would actually cause more auto accidents. He's speaking specifically about the requirement that everyone wear seatbelts, or not just cause more auto accidents, but cause more deaths, because it would induce people to drive more recklessly, and them driving more recklessly would kill more people than the seatbelts saved. And that turned out not to be true about those auto safety standards, just as his statement that thalidomide, that the disasters and birth defects that it caused actually are a price worth paying, so to speak, for the benefits of other drugs that would otherwise have been shut down by a more oppressive or more extreme regulatory apparatus. The point here is to construct a framework in which you can basically intellectualize opposition to whatever it is that you don't like, in particular, whatever policy the government has adopted that's unfriendly to your corporate interests. So it doesn't matter that it's not actually true that requiring everyone to wear a seatbelt doesn't cause more deaths, nor does it really matter what the welfare calculus is around the thalidomide birth defects versus the drugs that were invented under a loose, under a quote unquote too loose regulatory regime. The issue isn't the truth or falsity of those claims. The issue is their utility in the weaponization process that we had previously been discussing. And so, you know, you can kind of get away with being an economics professor if you spout off received wisdom and nuggets like that. It doesn't matter whether, as I said, doesn't matter whether the claim is true, because under this conception of what economics exists to do, it's not a positive social science. It is a intellectual construct or that enables you to argue in a certain way and make certain claims. So it's funny that you refer to the argument in favor of intellectual property as from the Hayekian perspective about how that makes use of decentralized information rather than having the government go around telling people what drugs to develop. That actually, probably the single tensest moment that I went through in graduate school, and we haven't really discussed the fact that I myself was trained in the University of Chicago Economics Department, but it's a crucial background to this. Concerned a lecture that Gary Becker, who's one of its leading lights, now deceased, but was then the lecturer in the course that they call price theory, along with Kevin Murphy, who's his younger protege, still active at the business school. They were giving a lecture about climate change, and they said that it was unnecessary to enact a carbon tax because that would distort prices. Of course, they're kind of defaulting to the free market take, not the we want monopolies take, because that actually creates dynamic innovation. We don't want carbon taxes. That would distort prices. The government can solve the climate change problem essentially by funding the research into the technologies that will decarbonize the atmosphere without humans having to change their behavior in any way. And I basically returned that Hayekian argument and said, well, you're saying the government knows what technologies to invest in. I think the best case for a carbon tax is exactly that it makes use of society's decentralized knowledge to determine which technologies are worth pursuing, even when their external cost is internalized in the form of the carbon tax, and which technologies and behaviors need to be abandoned in favor of remediating the climate. And both Becker and Murphy were not pleased to hear that at all. And as a first-year graduate student being yelled at by two of the most senior professors in the department in a lecture room filled with 50 or so people was not a very comfortable experience, and I think marked me out as not one of the elect from an early stage. Let's just say that.
Marshall, you tried to use their own logic. You said by your own logic.
Yes, by your logic. Yes, I didn't actually literally say that phrase out loud because I don't think that phrase had been invented ironic or reused ironically as it is now. This is, you know, way back in the day of, I don't know, 2009 or 2010, but I could have. And it was beautiful. Very vindicated.
Well, you're right, Marshall, that they kind of lean on one side of the arguments or the other depending on what they need. But just to kind of finish up the story of the pharmaceutical, neoliberal pharmaceutical science. I'll just say this quickly, but it does really give a sense of how some of these ideas take hold in the real world. Basically, out of the Chicago conference and the group of thinkers that assembled, this organization called the Center for the Study of Drug Development was founded. And it has a complex role to play in the story, and we don't need to go into it, but it was the guy who ran it. This is a great name. His name was Louis Lasagna. His last name was Lasagna. I kept reading this article, and it was like Lasagna said this or Lasagna said that. I was, being the juvenile person that I am, I was amused by it.
I'm just glad not all the villains in this story are Jews. Some of them are Italians.
I know, yeah. But then, but just to kind of show how this happens, so like that develops, and that's reliably producing information that are friendly to the pharmaceutical industries. In fact, it's funded by them, of course. And then AEI develops a kind of, I think it was called the Center for Health Policy Research, to kind of back up some of these claims. And pretty soon those on the people on the right start saying, well, we can do this for all different kinds of industries. And so like once the right-wing infrastructure was there, it was kind of, if you build it, they will come. And I think they started working with other industries as well. But I would just say that, Marshall, you noted that the kind of truth or falsity of these claims don't matter. And a lot of the talking points about the pharmaceutical industry that favor it came out of this group of people we're describing. For instance, the claim that it costs $800 million to produce a drug. They call it the $800 million pill meme. That came out of this group. And that's highly contestable. And also the drug, basically the idea that the U.S. lags far behind international markets when it comes to getting drugs out on the market, that claim too. It's just all information spit out of these kind of industry-friendly right-wing groups. And it's part of a system. There's an infrastructure around it now.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, pharma is a particularly noteworthy example of an industry that is like totally captured government with a business model that is absolutely hostile to the public interest and extremely exploitative of the public, using these kinds of claims that appeal to elites and experts that have, you know, then yoked us all to hundreds of dollars for needed insulin and other medications. You know, that's the price that we're paying, is like, oh, well, this is good for innovation. You know, those are arguments they came up with. I mean, the interesting thing about that is, you know, is this claim that like the US is far behind other countries when it comes to innovation because our regulatory process is just so onerous. You know, in some ways, the claims that those people make now are the diametric opposite of that, which is the rest of the world is reliant on American innovation in the pharmaceuticals sector. You know, and that is the result of our extremely onerous IP protections. So, you know, if we were to loosen those and thus make our drugs any cheaper for ourselves, you know, we would really be screwing over the rest of the country or the rest of the world that is benefiting from all the great drugs that are invented due to the system that these people have put in place. So yeah, I mean, if you're wondering like why pharma in particular is such a disaster in this country, you know, they really pioneered this use of sort of expert academic lobbying to get what they want when all of the policymakers who are behind the system are really pulling one over on the public. I mean, there's no way, you know, these people, these companies, you know, make a huge amount of money and their shareholders are rewarded amply. And it is all basically because they have a monopoly or an oligopoly that is legislated and enforced by government officials and organizations that they fund with the proceeds of that monopoly. You know, and in some ways it's kind of like that's exactly the most extreme example of like Stigler's theory of regulation, which is that it's captured by powerful insiders to prevent competition, and therefore we should have no regulation. You know, it's like this whole like he came up with that theory, and yet the entire edifice of this was like also brewed up in exactly the same lab that came up with this theory.
One of the sort of through lines between what we're talking about here, it seems like, is the fact that one of the innovations of the Chicago School style of thinking is that you can deploy these a priori theoretical models to any given sort of historical or political input in order to come away with a desired policy outcome, right? That like that proves the point that they set out to prove in the interest of preserving, you know, capital profit in a particular industry or suppressing the democratic whims of the public, where empiricism just simply doesn't matter nearly as much as a set of like normative outcomes that are desirable for the target beneficiaries of these ideas. And that one of the effects of that is sort of this colonization of other disciplines by this economicist thinking, where you apply these theoretical models to a new terrain and come away with the desired outcome, regardless of the like real empirical reality at work there. Like it creates this kind of loose epistemic terrain where you can apply this idea from over there and this idea from over there, and you have, you know, no real kind of obligation to be careful about the existing bodies of knowledge in another discipline. And one recent, like, really consequential and notable newsworthy example of this was this guy, Richard Epstein, writing this, what is effectively a blog for the Hoover Institution website about how the models about the severity of coronavirus were wrong, and, you know, in effect making the argument for, you know, not doing social distancing policy, social distancing norms as severely so as not to make, as Trump sort of took away from it, the cure worse than the disease. And there was a period of time in the last few weeks where conservatives from all over the map were kind of using a version of this argument to say, we're going to kill the economy on the basis of this model that is flawed. And this blog post that this guy Richard Epstein was pushing had this massive impact on the way that the federal government and influential people in the media were talking about the coronavirus, despite the fact that he is a lawyer. He has a connection to this constellation of institutions and thinkers is certainly not an epidemiologist, and that was on display in the interview that what's his name?
He gave with the New Yorker's Isaac Chotiner. And I thought Marshall, maybe you could, because this became something of, you know, everyone was reading it and sharing it and kind of mocking it. How did that interview where Epstein kind of laid out his coronavirus skepticism or trutherism to Chotiner, how, like, what marks of the Chicago school mind or the kind of law and economics mind were on display in that conversation?
Oh my God. So I don't know where to begin. Part of it is his sort of statement that, like, if we have a big societal problem, that problem will solve itself. And so, but it, unless the government gets in the way and screws it up, in that case, the problem will get worse. Right. So, for example, you know, his like weird theory of virology, I guess you would say, is that like viruses inherently become less communicable as they evolve. And like that has absolutely no basis in fact, but it's part of his statement that
they dwindle in potency.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, that's part of his statement that like the epidemic will go away, you know, so we better not shut down the economy because then like more people will die as a result of the economy being shut down than are killed by the virus. I mean, there's part of it at a sort of meta level of like, oh, you know, everybody else is part of the corrupt science establishment that wants more funding. You know, whereas I, the like lone white guy in my armchair who understands economics, can tell you exactly why those special interests are out for themselves and not the public interest, you know, by the application of a few, you know, basic principles of economics. I think, you know, so insofar as like he claims in the interview that like I actually have a background in epidemiology, what he's talking about is articles that he published in the 80s about the AIDS epidemic and basically the idea that if the government took steps to provide healthcare for people with AIDS, to treat their illness, to prevent its retransmission, then that would only result in more people contracting AIDS because they would be having riskier sex, basically. And so there's this sort of like combination of the moralization and like criticism of big government, you know, that like in this case would be preventing people from getting their just desserts of dying from AIDS effectively, you know, and thus harming the public because it doesn't harm, you know, the true cost of being, of having AIDS to the public is not suffered by any one of its victims. And so that means that like that will just encourage more of the behaviors that transmit AIDS, or HIV, I should say. And then finally, at the end of it, you know, he says something like, well, I'm not an empiricist. Well, it's like, okay, well, why are you making empirical claims about the trajectory of this virus? Like, I've seen that exact move pulled by these people when they're kind of pushed into a position of intellectual discomfort, which is like, okay, I'm not an empiricist. I'm just talking about economics here. You know, I'm not trying to like get my hands dirty with the data, but also it's really impossible to know anything empirically. All we can ever do is opine. You know, if your methods for supposedly figuring out how the world works, those are irreparably compromised. You'll never actually come up with anything. So, you know, the only thing that economics is good for is theorizing in a way that conforms with my views about how economic theory is supposed to be done.
And he kept saying the model.
And that's like a science-y word that they like to throw around. And like, okay, yes, epidemiologists also use that word, but they're not talking about the same thing. You know, it's.
So what's Epstein's model compared to the epidemiologist model?
Well, I mean, he's pressed on that in the interview and can't come up with it. I mean, part of it is like the virus will inevitably get less virulent over time. You know, part of it is like, I mean, it's one point, one of the more ridiculous things he said is like, well, if you understand general equilibrium theory, then you can see this. Well, okay, general equilibrium theory is like a particular aspect of economic theory from the 50s that was shown in the early 70s to have no empirical application in and of itself. I mean, it certainly has empirical, like, I mean, what was shown about it in the 70s was just the theory won't tell you anything about the world. You need to make restrictions on the theory. And the only thing that can provide those restrictions is actually observing reality. So it's basically a negative outcome for this entire branch of economic theory. But then it kind of, it's just like this phrase that filters down to some guy who knows that it's a phrase you can say in an interview in 2020 that like intimidates other people, because most people don't know what the hell general equilibrium theory is. They certainly don't know about the theorem that showed it doesn't tell you anything about reality, or at least not by itself. You know, so it's just all a sort of like pseudo intellectual like window dressing and decoration around essentially reactionary knee jerk groupthink. I just wanted to say, like, I don't want to oversimplify things here, but in that reading that interview just so clearly brings to mind all of the nonsense that circulated last summer when the other Epstein committed suicide, because it was so much like, oh, you know, we great thinkers, you know, can just sort of say anything. And like all the other little people who actually concern themselves with how the world works, you know, just aren't operating on our level. So all the academics that Jeffrey Epstein was funding, you know, they were of that type, basically. And they were of the type that validates the continued intellectual and economic domination of a retrograde like masterclass.
Don't wind up Matt on Epstein's qua Epstein.
Don't worry, I was not going to take that bait. We'll do an entire episode on Epstein.
Maybe
I'm joking, but I did just want to clarify. So Marshall, when Richard Epstein says model, I mean, really, that's just a way of saying, like, you can pack your presuppositions into the model, and that's what you're working with. It's really an elaborate way of saying, like, here are my base assumptions about how the world should work, whether or not it does work that way. It often doesn't, you know, be damned. And then when he's called on what those assumptions are by Chotiner, he doesn't have an answer because he just pulls them out of his ass.
Yes.
But that's what the model means. Like the model kind of means my assumptions.
Yes. That is what all of that. Yeah.
If you read the Chotiner interview, you think, well, why the fuck did this happen? Like, why did this man who clearly knows nothing about this subject get the ear of the president of the United States and, you know, well, and initially a bunch of, you know, rich people close to the president of the United States? And why would anyone have thought that what he had to say was of value? And I think that sort of gets us back to how successful these people have been at insinuating themselves into power and also at sort of normalizing the idea that somebody who knows how to speak in a particular idiom that sounds like economics is given the right to speak on any issue using the same idiom. Like, Chotiner is a great interviewer, so that's why you see, oh, wait, this is all bullshit. What he's saying is made up. It doesn't make any sense. But in a lot of cases, like, people like Epstein do the same thing and get interviewed in newspapers and use the same idiom and are treated like serious thinkers because that language has become so successfully associated with academic, intellectual, and policy authority.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, you gotta just sort of reduce it to materialism at this point. It's like the reason why this mode has been so successful is because it flatters rich people, and rich people endow academic organizations and pay for professorships and decide who has a megaphone loud enough to be heard in the press. In many cases, promulgated themselves because they own the press. So, you know, there are aspects of the thought qua thought that give rise to the idea that the fact that, Epstein is the one whose, you know, cracked theory is gets heard by the president, but it's also just material interests made it that way. And they created the larger situation that you're talking about, which is this is the language of policy. This is what the language you have to speak in order to be taken seriously. And in some ways, that it's most pernicious and most successful exactly because it is broken out of this narrow confines of people who would say that they themselves are affiliated with the Chicago School. Like, you hear that basic mindset coming from people way far afield, including, as we earlier mentioned, people who would say, in fact, that they're directly diametrically opposed to the Chicago School, nonetheless operate in the same kind of intellectual context.
Yeah, yeah. And you can see how this is, I mean, ties into something we've talked about on the show before, which is, so you have Epstein, you know, publishing his kind of corona skepticism, corona trutherism, shutdown trutherism. But then you also have someone like Rusty Reno and First Things publishing very similar arguments, but from like a moralizing standpoint, right? Like, oh, we can't shut down churches because that's kind of giving the government a say over how we run our religious institutions. And so you kind of add it all up, and it means there's this information circulating, at least, you know, in right-wing networks, that all kind of goes toward justifying Trump's totally inept and quite frankly, criminal response to the coronavirus, including piddling away 2 months doing nothing. You know, because it's like, well, if we should be skeptical about the whole thing, who's to say what the right thing to do would have been? You know, you aren't God. You know, how can you know? And it just muddies the water. And you have kind of different factions of the right all springing into action to just make people skeptical about what we actually knew about this virus, what the best practices would have been to combat it, and kind of why taking the advice of seasoned epidemiologists was the wrong thing to do.
And it's not just in defense of Trump. It's also in defense of basically throwing the bodies of working class yes. people at the virus, while people like Rusty Reno and Trump and Richard Epstein continue to stay home and try not to get it and give it to their families. Like, the idea of reopening the economy was never the idea of everybody goes back to work. The idea of reopening the economy was people who play an important role in production at the point of production and distribution go back to work. So the economy starts working again. It is a baldly eliminationist class war against the people who actually make the economy run, but whose health and safety these people do not give a shit about.
Right. No, I totally agree. And it can favor Trump in a sort of incidental way. That's why I use the phrase muddy the waters. You know, it's not that they wake up in the morning and say, I want to do Trump a solid.
Right, yeah, it's just all the same thing, though, because that's Trump's agenda, too. He has an eliminationist agenda against the poor people of this country, so.
We didn't want to talk to Marshall without turning to the role of James Buchanan in kind of libertarian circles and in the American right in the post-war era more broadly, and specifically the way he was treated in Nancy MacLean's book, Democracy in Chains, which Marshall, I think your review of that book and kind of intervention in that debate in the Boston Review a couple years ago, right around the time of Charlottesville, actually, because that book came out around the time of the Unite the Right March in Charlottesville and everything that followed. And it's another kind of real world example of how these ideas, what uses they're put to, how they're funded, what the institutional support for them is, and kind of, again, how the Chicago School and kind of libertarianism more broadly touches down on the real world when it comes to actually existing policies and programs and, you know, recent political history.
It's important because we haven't really addressed how all of this stuff relates to, like, white supremacy, the reaction to the civil rights movement, the reaction to desegregation, or to other sort of, like, movements, uprisings of the lower orders during, you know, the 50s and 60s and 70s.
Yeah, so I will totally unselfconsciously ask that and tout my own book review of Nancy MacLean's book, Democracy in Chains. It's called The Book That Explains Charlottesville and the Boston Review. It's on their website because, you know, it's one of the most controversial things I've ever written. It's also one of the most, one of the things I'm most proud of because it captured something that you were just alluding to that is really unacknowledged by contemporary economists and that MacLean sort of talks about in the book, but in a way the book is so confined that it doesn't quite make the claim as boldly and as ambitiously as it deserves to be made. So to give a little bit of background, James Buchanan was himself trained at the University of Chicago. He ended up as a young professor at the University of Virginia, where he got involved in effect as the academic arm of what was called massive resistance. So this was in response to the Brown v. Board of Ed Supreme Court decision. The state of Virginia, under its kind of political boss, Harry Byrd, who was a senator, a U.S. senator, but he, you know, had wielded great power within the state political system, basically decided, you know, we're not going to abide by the federal, by the Supreme Court's dictate of desegregating the schools. Instead, we will actually just eliminate public schooling in the state. As I mean, I don't want to go into exactly the history of how this played out in the 50s in Virginia, but in effect, what MacLean's book shows is that Buchanan was in the vanguard of formulating the kind of intellectual wing of that obviously political and reactionary political tendency by this idea that you know, you want to that public schooling as a whole is inefficient. It's this, you know, a kind of top-down bureaucracy, and instead of more, as it became kind of instantiated in the current intellectual environment, a better way to run an education system is to have total privatization. So what that would mean is state grants to individuals to select a school that they want to attend. I mean, in effect, exactly the same way that our higher education system works under a system of federal student loans. They wanted that at the K-12 level. And the obvious significance of that in the context of massive resistance to Brown v. Board of Ed is what Brown v. Board of Ed said is if the state is going to create a public education system, it cannot create that system in such a way that discriminates on the basis of race. And so the response on the part of massive resistance is, okay, then we won't have a public education system. And Buchanan's contribution to that effort was, in effect, well, we don't want a public education system. It would actually be a better way of running things to have the entire school system be privatized. And of course, if a private school system ends up with all the white kids in one school and all the black kids in another, the black kids not going to school at all, that's not a problem vis-a-vis Brown v. Board of Ed, because it's not the state discriminating. That is the result of private decisions. Okay. Buchanan kind of formulated, I mean, this was the time in which his overall economic philosophy was taking shape. It's called now public choice. Really, you know, it's based on publications that ultimately came out in the 60s. And what it is, as is shown in McLean's book, but also more generally, is basically a kind of, I mean, the way he would have described it is an economic way of describing politics and political decisions. So it's applying this methodology of individual optimization that we have attributed to the Chicago School to the subject of politics, political outcomes, and policymaking in some cases. The way I would reinterpret it, as I did in that review, is as reinterpreting democratic bottom-up demands, social movements that make demands on the political system as, in fact, special interests vying for power and influence and rents from the state. So, for example, when Buchanan later ended up at UCLA, where he was outraged by student protest movements, and that's where he wrote the book that ultimately influenced the Higher Education Act of 1972. So that book is Academia and Anarchy. Effectively, you know, what he was reacting to is this idea that the California Master Plan was the state higher education policy that was put in place in the 60s that to some degree universalized higher education, though of course it never actually achieved that. That brought in a huge swath of students to the UC system that weren't the kind of people that Buchanan thought belonged on a college campus. And so he reinterpreted something like the California Master Plan as a giveaway to special interests, namely civil rights leaders and civil rights movements that were demanding access to higher education. You know, likewise, I think some great scholarship has been done on this by David Stein, also at UCLA, as it happens, I think, about the Federal Reserve in the late 70s. You know, that at that point, part of the civil rights movement had, in terms of federal demands, transition to macroeconomic policy should take into account racialized outcomes. You know, unemployment in cities is causing urban unrest. So, you know, it's the Federal Reserve's job to deal with that problem by minimizing unemployment. You know, there was a huge backlash against that, also from the Chicago School, that basically posed that kind of social movement claim to influence over policy as a special interest demanding that the optimal policy be perverted in their direction. And so, you know, that's the kind of thing that has to be shut down, ultimately constitutionalized. So what Buchanan is probably best known for before McLean's book came out was his influence over the Chilean constitution that put in place by Pinochet that basically made it impossible to have egalitarian rule in Chile, even if, you know, you win an election. That doesn't mean you can actually enact a progressive income tax, that kind of thing. Or, I mean, they privatize the social security system, for example. You know, all of these things are constitutionalized in a way that removes them from democratic contestation. Buchanan was kind of a fringe figure in his own time, and you know, there are very, very few, if any, economists now who are like, yes, I'm in the school of Buchanan. I mean, the only place you find those people would be in right-wing think tanks and, you know, academic departments that they fully control and totally dominate. The white supremacist adjacent aspect of Buchanan's scholarship is something that affects the field much more broadly than the man himself. So for one thing, this whole business of school choice as being a way of undermining Brown v. Board of Ed, you know, it was basically the same time Buchanan was saying that, Milton Friedman was saying exactly the same thing. That's what, you know, he's now looked at as like the father of the school choice movement, because he, in like the publication which he did that was in 1955, you know, obviously directly in the aftermath of Brown v. Board of Ed. And like, I looked this up a few weeks ago, the Milton Friedman personal estate was bequeathed to like a foundation that advocates for school choice, and is, you know, now I guess they have like so much money else, so much other money in that world, that I'm sure Milton Friedman's own personal fortune is not the main driving force in these kind of teachers union busting and charter school voucherization kind of movements. But, you know, that's basically where it got to. And you can see the retrograde, especially racialized impact of that in the way that the school choice movement operates, both with respect to its criticisms of the teaching profession and in the idea that urban school systems need to be replaced by de facto privatization and, you know, different types of schools for different types of people. I mean, you get this, that ideology strongly comes through when you talk about, you know, the sorts of curricula and pedagogy that's undertaken in urban charter schools. It's like very much as you, I mean, the way you could rephrase it, the way that you talked about Epstein's characterization of how to reopen the economy under coronavirus. It's like, all right, you know, these are the people who need the kind of education that makes them productive, docile workers. And like, that's what charter schools exist to provide. And like, yes, you know, if you're a different kind of student, then maybe you deserve to, you know, read and write and think independently. That's what school's for you. But that's not what school's for school children whom these charter schools are there to serve. And
Achievement Academy style, like, right. Discipline as a first principle.
One thing that seems to come up in the debates around this is an argument like, well, Buchanan wasn't being explicitly racist, right? And how do you respond to that charge? And what I'm getting at is the idea that, like, basically this economic view of things, it views any bottom-up democratic movement as essentially rent-seeking, right? So like, you could overlay these ideas. If you overlay these ideas on the American context, like, it's going to be kind of a push against kind of racial equity and any kind of civil rights movement or something like desegregation. But if you overlay these ideas in the context of Chile, or, you know, pick any other country or context, in a formal sense, it's a way of rendering any bottom-up democratic movement is illegitimate or somehow being reducible to just kind of mooching and rent seeking.
Right. Well, as Shuja said on our country music episode, quoting Stuart Hall, in America, race is the modality in which class is lived. So if James Buchanan's theory is reinterpreting the struggle of the lower orders for democratic inclusion as a form of rent-seeking or self-interested politicking, then of course it's going to be about race, racism, and racial exclusion in the American context.
Yes, and I guess, Marshall, like, one thing I'm teeing you up for is it seems like this very frustrating pattern emerges again and again, where you say, well, was James Buchanan actually a racist? And it's like, to some degree, I don't care.
Who the fuck cares?
Yeah, I don't care, like, what deep down is in James Buchanan's heart. It's, you have to look at the structure of his arguments and how they interacted with the political history of that moment. But it seems like the debates, like, it seems hard to engage libertarians and the right more broadly at that level.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a well beyond the actual out and out self-described right or libertarians. The denial of white supremacy, other than attributing it to people who express and hold explicitly racist views, is a, you know, tried and true tradition in American history. So, you know, the fact that Buchanan and the rest of them engage in it is not necessarily unique to that. I mean, it was specifically frustrating in the context of the debate over McLean's book, because of course all of his latter day defenders and friends and colleagues, in terms of their recipients of the same kind of philanthropic support, you know, wanted to move the debate as much as possible to that terrain.
Right.
Because that's a way of neutering it. You know, anytime you bring up the intellectual history of racism and white supremacy in America, it's like, okay, well, if you don't have the person secretly saying slurs behind closed doors, then racism doesn't exist, white supremacy doesn't exist. I mean, it's important to you know, kind of put this in the overall context of like the economics professions, like overall theories of race and white supremacy.
Yeah, please do.
Which were not the identical with Buchanan's, but certainly consistent or continuous with them. Which, you know, here again, I'm talking about especially this guy, Gary Becker, the guy who disagreed with my take on carbon taxes and climate change, is, you know, notable for an economic theory of discrimination that basically says overt racism is, as instantiated in discrimination on the basis of race, is economically inefficient because you're basically letting your prejudices get in the way of your economic interest. And so as a result, in a competitive economy, overt racism will eventually be competed out of existence by more assiduous and kind of single-mindedly self-interested and not motivated by these baser passions, I guess self-interest being a higher passion according to these people, you know, that will go away. And that had an enormous effect, I would say decisive effect, on the economic scholarship of race and race-related issues up until very recently, if not still ongoing. As, you know, it's like a bunch of white people who deny the existence of white supremacy or kind of rationalize it as saying like, okay, well, it's economically inefficient, so eventually it'll go away. So why does the government have to do anything about it? You know, and it particularly doing things that actually make it worse, like affirmative action. You know, all of that is kind of bound up in the same kind of retrograde thinking that radically reduces and attributes racism to like the actions and beliefs of individual people. It's worth kind of going over the experience of the publication of that book, Democracy in Chains, because it's so revealed. I mean, in some ways, it like performed the thesis of the book.
It's worth mentioning that Buchanan did end up at George Mason.
Yeah, yeah. That's why basically George Mason is what it is today, at least the economics part. It started as the seed.
Yes, because we had mentioned him being at, we mentioned him being at UVA and then he went to UCLA. But then second half of his career, slightly later in his career, he went to George Mason. And we should talk about that and talk about the reception of the book. But I did just want to mention too, I heard James Buchanan speak before he died at a IHS gathering. But I did just want to say the only thing I remember from that talk is him saying that he wasn't religious, but if he had to pick a religion, it would be Mormonism. and me, like at the time, I thought, oh, this is just like a pervy old guy who wanted multiple wives or something. You know, like I thought it was like some weird reference to that. Even though I know Mormon changed on that, whatever. But it turns out it's just he thought they made perfect capitalists.
A tiny note on that, IHS, which basically was like the reconstituted Volcker Fund, to bring it back.
Yes, 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 exactly. Yeah, yeah.
All those things were bound up with each other at the start. But yeah, it's Koch money, George Mason, James Buchanan. He's a bit of a fiefdom there. And so that sprung into action when this book came out and was being reviewed, and that you probably got tangled up in quite a bit, Marshall.
Yeah, tell us about it.
Yeah, so, I mean, what happened was a bunch of, you know, the book came out, it was obvious that it triggered off the Koch network, you know, machine to sort of fire off volley after volley about how it was bad scholarship, that she got the facts wrong, that she misquoted this or that, and you know, they have a certain mode of operating. And I guess I knew what it was before that came out. And you know, that only kind of showed it much more fully, I would say, in how they kind of prosecute their aims. But it's like, okay, you know, on the one hand, you have the Richard Epsteins out there saying like, well, nobody can really know anything. And anybody, you know, I can be an expert on epidemiology. On the other hand, then they kind of activate the other people who kind of go line by line through the book, you know, turn up something irrelevant that's like, this letter, you know, it's like, okay, well, McLean quotes like one paragraph of this letter. But actually, if you look at, you know, another paragraph in the letter, you can see that she misrepresented it, which isn't actually true. If you go to the whole letter, she didn't actually misrepresent it. But if they can say like, oh, she took it out of context, then that provides the data point that that they need to kind of say, oh, well, she's not a real scholar. This is just a work, a smear job. You know, and they kind of pulled that over and over again and had this coming. And I mean, the other aspect of it was so many different people at so many different institutions with so many different affiliations kind of saying the same thing makes you think like, oh, well, if all of these people are saying that, you know, giving this criticism about how she's not a real scholar, like maybe there's something to it. It's not just the people at George Mason. It's not just the people who are, you know, obviously to the public affiliated with Buchanan and or the Koch brothers or anything else. Well, actually, it is all those people. It's just that they have a gigantic academic network, a huge set of funding recipients. And so all these people that you think are just, you know, someone out there independently coming to their own conclusion about how the book is flawed is actually part of the same general kind of smear job. And it's just operating through different mouthpieces. And that's exactly the benefit of having such a broad network that's seemingly unconnected to one another, unless you sort of know what's going on. So there was that. And then there was like, okay, well, you know, she, McLean herself kind of pointed this out. And it's like, oh, well, she's a conspiracy theorist, you know, denying the reality of all of these critiques that real scholars have brought. You know, so they kind of got to that second round of the criticism. I mean, the thing that really caught, I mean, I remember literally where I was sitting, you know, and I kind of made the decision that like, oh, I got to write a review of this thing because this is going off the rails. Was a response from Henry Farrell and Steve Tellis that basically took the side of the critics. And, you know, that so Tellis is the author of a book, you should probably interview him at some point, called The Conservative Legal Movement, about like the Federalist Society, specifically the right-wing attempts to take over the federal judiciary. And I mean, I guess those are posterior to the law and economics movement in U.S. law school. So building these institutes of law and economics, the Olin Foundation and so on, endowing these things. This is kind of the outgrowth and weed-like behavior of the Chicago school, the part of the Chicago school that was at the law school, you know, kind of bursting out and infecting every law school in the country. You know, so Tellis is like considered a good scholar of conservatism. Farrell is a political philosopher, I think is what he would, I mean, he's definitely in the political science department at George Washington, a scholar of international relations. But anyway, you wouldn't say they were like part of this group. And indeed, I still wouldn't say that, but my views on that have evolved to some degree. Tellis is on the board of the Niskanen Center, Niskanen Institute, which
they're the good boy libertarians.
Well. They're, I mean, part of the my kind of getting wise to them was that even though they claim to be the refugees from the malign influence of Charles Koch on the libertarian movement, in fact, they all jumped to attention when the attacks on Nancy McLean started in exactly the same way that every other aspect of the Koch network jumped to attention. And that's because they claim to be the intellectual descendants of Buchanan and believers in public choice, while, you know, Koch is this nefarious influence who's kind of perverted the movement in his own particular political aims. But, you know, there's a core intellectual tradition here that is actually worthwhile and worth defending. And so, you know, when that was brought into question by McLean scholarship, they were just as there on the front lines as anybody else. Anyway, Farrell and Tellis, I felt like what had gone on was this, you know, just total drawing of the disciplinary lines such that McLean's book and the important things that it had to say about Buchanan and its intellectual his intellectual legacy could be put in a box and totally ignored. And that, I mean, given the economics profession's problems with its own history on scholarship related to race and many other issues, I just felt like that was a kind of intellectual failure of the first order, because she has a lot to say. I mean, as I said in the review, she has a lot.
And she's a historian, right?
Yeah, she's right. She's a historian.
She's a really excellent historian at Duke. And I mean, years ago, I read her book on the Klan, Women in the Klan.
Yeah, I was going to say her subject is the history of white supremacy. That's what she studies. And so, you know, the fact that she wrote a whole book on Buchanan and his intellectual movement and where it fits in the kind of solar system of American white supremacy, it's significant in its own right.
Yeah. And because she really, the book starts with John C. Calhoun.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she locates James Buchanan and public choice and kind of contemporary libertarianism in the Calhounian anti-democratic strain of thinking, kind of anti-democratic thinking in service of white supremacy that's, you know, reaches back, well, as long as our country's existed, basically.
It's also funny, this is just a tiny little point, that, you know, these people like who get so upset when a historian writes about economics and the economics discipline, who sort of like the whole premise, one of the premises we've been working with is that they have like totally imperialized like every other discipline and treated it like their stomping grounds, like in sometimes in like with explicit, deliberate you know, strategy of being like, no, this is the domain of economics now. Whenever like somebody punches back a little bit and is like, hey, actually, like my discipline has something to say about what you guys have done, they freak out and say, you have nothing to say about us.
Yes. Yeah. And that's also why the sort of Koch interests have been so assiduous at funding the subfield of economics that studies the history of economics, because, you know, they basically want to be able to write their own history. And, you know, if you talk to history of economics scholars, Murawski and Nikka that we were previously discussing come out of that tradition. You know, obviously those scholars are quite not the history of the discipline that the Koch brothers and their allies want told. You know, what you'll hear from other history of thought people is, well, nobody else wants to pay for us to do our work and publish about it. So like basically we're the sort of hated stepchildren of the economics profession. At least these right-wing interests have some reasons why they want to hear from us and have us do our thing. And, you know, it's like, well, that's because everything is part of their overall, you know, political, ideological strategy and institution building and so on. And like, this fits in perfectly. So like, of course, those people were also in the fray shutting down McLean and saying that she had nothing to say about economics at all, and specifically about Buchanan. And I just, you know, I thought like, this is such an important part of the discipline's history that if they get away with saying that it's not good scholarship, you know, that's just like intellectual crime of the first proportion. I mean, it would just to kind of, I guess, wrap up one aspect of this discussion, like, yes, McLean has quite a lot to say about Calhoun and the locus of small government, anti-democratic and white supremacist politics as being a through line in the history of American white supremacy. I felt that she did not do justice to the backlash to the Reconstruction period in the United States, which was really where you see the like first weaponization of free market ideology in order to shut down racially egalitarian public policies, especially on the federal level. I mean, you could say, you know, the Civil War itself was the, you know, most extreme, like big government federal domination, episode of federal domination in service of racial egalitarianism in U.S. history. And like a big part of free market ideology is constructing an alternative history where that was bad for the economy, where that reflected the pernicious influence of a special interest on federal policy. You know, I would say one of the most radicalizing, I mean, not just the discourse with Becker and Murphy about climate change. I remember one discussion among colleagues at the University of Chicago where somebody said to me, basically, the North should not have fought the Civil War. They should have allowed the South to secede, in effect, you know, because that was the popular will of the Southerners, was not to be part of the United States. So it's like, all right, okay. So one thing you just told me is that you don't think black people are people. Let's start there, because there were 4 million slaves in the Confederacy, and they certainly didn't get a vote on secession. You know, secondly, that's like nothing remotely like the political history of secession, is that it was like the popular will of the Southern people to declare their independence. Like, Southern slaveholders weren't getting what they wanted out of the federal government anymore, and saw it now as a threat to their power. So they had to not be part of it. And the idea that that's like, it's actually, you know, oppress a big government to have the North enforce the Union in the South, you know, is just exactly the kind of jujitsu history that, like, the Dunning School that ultimately, you know, that was the sort of initial apologist for the Reconstruction era. I mean, it's just that like revived, you know, in a kind of economistic language, you know, from the contemporary era. And like, it's like,
oh yeah, well, it's because, you know, even like Thomas DiLorenzo, if you've ever come across his shit, writing books about how the Civil War was really just about tariffs. Didn't you know that, Marshall? That it was just about tariffs. And so even the causes of the war themselves, race is kind of, you know, pushed aside. And the Civil War itself is simply a dispute about tariffs and
economics.
Well, maybe that's not the worst place to end, actually.
Yeah, Marshall, you have a concluding thought?
I mean, I think we've, you know, pretty effectively stressed the fact that, like, these ideas have been enormously influential and still are. I think it's interesting, and I'm not entirely sure what the answer is as to the question of whether the Chicago School actually still exists as such. So, like, clearly the ideas have had some afterlife, but on the other hand, as extensive as the Koch funding is and as influential as it is in academia, and as the people at George Mason seem to be able to get quoted in the press or get themselves invited to think tank confabs or whatever in DC pretty much whenever they want. And they certainly can get appointments in the Trump administration and have Richard Epstein stuff be read by the president. It's like, do these people as an academic movement and an intellectual movement still exist as such in the way that we have been describing them and characterizing them throughout? And in some ways, I would say basically the answer is no. Like the fact that, you know, even though their views are essentially the views of the federal judiciary and the views of a lot of people who have power over what actually happens in this country, it's like they have succeeded and in some ways put to bed the era in the intellectual movement that gave rise to them or that birthed them. So it's like it doesn't matter that they don't have an academic following anymore and that basically very few, if any, academics, certainly none that don't receive their funding would say, I am a member of the Chicago School.
Right, but there's an extent to which they won. They instantiated their ideas as a sort of hegemony in the profession and in the political world that's informed by it, and so no longer really need to name themselves as a school. Like as we said earlier, it's the air we breathe.
But I would just say one thing, which is that my takeaway from this conversation is that the worldview underlying what we've been discussing, the Chicago School, public choice, the kind of econometric view of reality, it's such an impoverished view of human beings, and it's such an impoverished view of the world. And the things, whether it's Richard Epstein with his Corona Trutherism, or whether it's the quote I read from the gentleman who suggested he'd be willing to risk any number of widespread birth defects.
Sam Peltzman.
it's really a disgusting worldview on display, and it's such an impoverished view of human beings. And I think being a libertarian is akin to being a sociopath. it should be in the DSM-4. These people view the world and other human beings in such a disgusting and repulsive way. Reading what we read for today's episode is just disgusting. And I think these people are kind of wicked and really nasty in a very particular kind of way. And yeah, I think they're really some of the worst people in the world.
I mean, I totally agree with that. I don't know, like if you psychologize your intellectual opponents though, then you dehistoricize them. Like, I agree with you. They're horrible.
You can do both.
I know they're horrible. I mean, it's not even a matter of like, you know, I have gone through fire and seen what these people do and think, and like they are as bad as you say. But doing that doesn't tell us how they came to be what they are and how they have so much influence, I guess.
Matt is permitted a moralizing soliloquy at the end of every episode,
right? And Marshall, I would just remind us of one thing: that it is the power of the word "and." We can historicize and psychologize. Because their evilness, it contains multitudes.
You want to relegate this personality type, which is both historical and psychological, to, you know, the status of sort of like a radical inhuman evil. But the fact is that like its norms are pervasive in our society. If you are attuned to it, it's absolutely everywhere. Every time somebody talks about some sort of social or intimate interaction in terms of like incentives and disincentives. Yeah, I think it's a desiccated way of conceiving of the obligations of human beings to each other. It is also the way in which it is the underlying ideology of American capitalism to a significant extent.
I agree. It's a really unlovely view of the world.
Yes, and we're living through the consequences of it right now.
We're living through the consequences of it, and I'm grateful to Marshall for helping explain it to us and our listeners.
Yeah, me too.
Well, I'm glad to finally have had the opportunity, long overdue appearance on this excellent podcast, so I'm glad you finally came around to the right way of seeing things. It's been a pleasure.
And just in case any listeners have any doubt, Marshall, I'm very fond of you. I consider you a good friend.
Well, thank you.
And I'm really grateful you came on Sam and I's podcast.
and I'm genuine, even though we play up the dom sub relationship that we have with you on the internet, it's always meant a lot to me that you have supported the podcast and that you approve of it, because you're such a smart and thoughtful writer and thinker and tweeter, and so it's always been very much appreciated that you have been an early adopter of the Know Your Enemy lifestyle.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it has definitely improved my life, and I'm grateful to you for putting together a great thing and having had so many excellent episodes, not including this one.
All right. Thank you, Marshall.
Thanks, man.
Okay. Yep. Bye-bye.